Hello everyone, and welcome to today's Art Chat with Linda Fissler. My name is Sherry Haas, and I'll be your moderator today. A few things before we get started. We are recording today's Art Chat, and it'll be posted later at artistnetwork.com and our Artist Network YouTube page. So if you want to listen again, or if you know someone who is unable to join us live, please find it there and feel free to share it. Also, we'll have some time for you to ask questions at the end of today's chat. If you look on your GoToWebinar control panel on the right side of your screen, you'll see a little question box, and that's where you can type in your questions for Linda and her guests at any time, and I'll relay them on your behalf. Okay, it's time to turn things over to Linda. Welcome, Linda. I'll let you take it from here.
Okay, thanks, Sherry, and welcome everybody to Art Chat. Today we have Jennifer McChristian with us, and Jennifer has some really exciting and interesting workshops coming up. And when I talked to her on the phone, I guess over the last couple months, it became really interesting to me to hear about her philosophy and how she runs a workshop and what, you know, she likes to do in the workshop and different things like that. So I thought we'd take it from the perspective of if you ever wanted to conduct a workshop, these are things that you would need to think about. And Jennifer, I haven't been to one of Jennifer's workshops, but Jennifer and I have talked a lot over the last few years, I guess ever since we met at, what was that, Weekend with Masters. Yeah, in California and San Diego. So we've been together talking and about art and all different kind of things for that many years. So welcome, Jennifer, and I appreciate your time in doing this. And then let's skip to like the first question that I've got here, and it's like, tell us how you structure your workshop. Do you prefer 3 or 5 day workshops, or, you know, is there a progression that you go through each day that kind of makes sense to you that you found works for your students?
Typically I like to do 5 day workshops as opposed to 3, although I am open to doing 3 day workshops in the future. There's so much information entailed when doing a workshop, so I try to break it up into segments throughout the week, focusing on different topics and stuff, so I can like give them like bite-sized, manageable information that they can digest throughout the week. So it's really depends on how I organize it, but usually it's 5 days, and on the first day, I have like an orientation in the morning, and that's basically when we meet, and then I hand out student notes and their packets and stuff with little complimentary viewfinders and stuff, and then that's kind of like, it takes about like maybe like an hour and a half or so, and I just give them an itinerary of the week, and I talk about, you know, what they're going to expect out of the workshop and what I'll be covering. And I also like to do like a little round robin thing with the artists and the students so they can kind of introduce themselves briefly and say what they're there for and what they expect out of the workshop and what they'd like to learn and their weak spots and their strengths and so. So that kind of helps to break the ice and lets everyone, you know, get to know each other. Mm-hmm. And then in the afternoon, the first day I kind of keep it relatively easy and relaxed because some people are coming from long ways. They might be jet lagged and stuff. So I usually start like at 10 o'clock. And then once the orientation is over, I'll do a black and white or value exercise, which I emphasize a lot during the workshop. And and then in the afternoon, they're on their own to do the exercise that I show them. And, of course, I do, like, individual critiques where I go around and talk to everyone and see their progress. So that's on the first day. Mm-hmm. And then on the second day, I basically do another value exercise, and then I get into color. So, again, like I was saying, it's a lot of information, so I don't want to bombard them with too much stuff on the first day. So the second day, I kind of ease them into color, and I talk about my color palette and, you know, my limited color palette and mixing greens and grays and all that stuff. And I do also a little swatches, like color demo swatches. So I'll mix the color in front of them and talk about what I'm doing or which colors I'm mixing to get what I want and stuff like that. And mm-hmm. that takes quite a bit of time because I'm introducing color to them, and I'm also still talking about like design, which is part of the value subject that I talk about on the first day. And then in the afternoon, once I do the demo, in the afternoon, they're they're set off on their own to do their value exercise, and then also a small little color comp, which is basically just, you know, taking a small panel and just doing like a little color comp and just kind of practicing color and stuff like that. And then on third day, I always had them do a value exercise prior to their painting. But I do a demo. I do a demo like pretty much every day. Okay. In the morning. Sometimes on Thursdays, I'll give them the option to paint all day. And then I'll do a demo in the afternoon, and it's optional if they want to sit in and watch, or they can just paint. Mm-hmm. So that they kind of like that, because it's like a lot of them are like chomping at the bit to do like more painting and stuff. So it's like I give them the choice, like, well, you can sit in and watch, or you can come in and check in, or you can just like paint the whole day. Mm-hmm. And then on day five, again, I do a demo, and then they, they paint and stuff, and I try to do like a little closing lecture where we do like a show and tell, and then maybe I might go into a Q&A and talk about other stuff. Like marketing and whatnot. So each day is pretty much structured. I start at around like 9:30 and then go until like maybe 4:30. I don't mind going over too. A lot of times I just go over the time, and that's not a big deal for me, because mm-hmm. I'm just out there having fun, and I'll stay as long, until the last person leaves. So,
Okay.
So
a curiosity question for me. Do you like them to start painting in the afternoon because the light doesn't move as quickly as it does in the morning, so it really gives them an advantage, like if you're focusing on value, to really sit there and study the scene. I mean, light still moves naturally in the afternoon, but I think it slows down. It probably doesn't. It's so weird because, the earth turns at a certain speed, but that's the scientific answer. But, in some ways, the flat shadows, the flat light and everything is pretty consistent for a longer per time than when in the morning when it's rising quicker.
That's a good point, because for them it's beneficial because they're learning new information, and I don't want them to rush through their exercises. So if there's, the light is consistent, then they don't have to feel like stressed out and rushed throughout their exercise. But it also depends on the demo. Like if I have enough time, if I finish the demo in time for them to do some painting before lunch, because I forgot to mention they do make them go to lunch for an hour. make them paint all day. Yeah, if there is time beforehand, then I'll have them do like little thumbnails or a little exercise that might not take as long, and then they can come back in the afternoon and paint the same scene or choose a different scene if they so choose.
Okay. So, yeah, and I guess that also depends on, well, we'll get to that question later. I don't want to jump into that one yet. So tell us a little bit more about you per se, and that is you basically, your workshops are all plein air, is that correct?
Yeah, they're pretty much all plein air at this point. And I did offer some still life classes a long time ago in my studio, but I just love being outdoors and just I just love it. So it's just more adventurous and
then you also do, because I know we have talked about this, so this isn't going to be a surprise to you, but you also do in your studio life drawing, right? So you have models come in?
Yeah, those aren't instructed though. So we've been running those workshops for about like maybe 16 years, thereabouts, mm-hmm. 17 years. So those are the 3 times a week, and they're 3-hour sessions, and even though it's off topic with the plein air, I think it's a great idea that students really try to get as much drawing in as they can, because like painting to me is the basis of drawing is the basis of painting. So I think getting as much drawing mileage is wonderful, and I think it'll facilitate their a painting during their workshops.
Right. We talked. I don't want to talk so much about like the specific elements that you cover in a workshop, like value or drawing or things like mm-hmm. that. But from an instructor's point of view, Are there certain things that you do maybe before the students show up on site that help you provide a better workshop experience? It makes the workshop go smoother. Do you do trips beforehand, like a couple weeks beforehand to pick out sites or?
Oh, okay, kind of things.
Yeah.
I do. I try to give myself at least a couple of days prior to the workshop. That's a good question too, because I like to kind of, especially if I haven't been there before, if it's like a new location for me, I like to go and scout out locations and see what, you know, what I'm in for and the kind of light and the different, you know, subject matter that I can play around with. But the places that I've been to over and over again, like Ojai, I teach there yearly. So I know all the places, and I pretty much painted all of Ojai. So that's a little bit easier for me. But if it's like a brand new place, then, yeah, typically I like to have some days beforehand, if it's possible, to kind of scout around and see what I have as options for painting.
Right, and then I assume that because Kevin used to do this when we used to do the workshops, you know, he would go on this scouting tour beforehand, and just like you were talking about, a few days beforehand, and or maybe even if they're gonna, you know, if it's overseas, which we'll get into talking about in a little bit, but you know, he'll actually go at the same time of year and spend a week there painting, and you know, and then book the workshop for that time. You know, the next year. Of course, you can't guarantee that weather is going to be exactly the same, but you know, it gives him an idea of the, you know, the conditions that he might be painting in if you see that. So, and of course, in the United States, it's a lot easier because you're more familiar with you know, what goes on, and hopefully you have people that live in the area that can also tell you what's going on with the weather at that point. But you also go one step further, which is, you know, okay, on Monday, you know, if it rains, what I'm getting to is like contingency plans. Well, if it rains, we'll do this. If it's sun shining, we'll do this.
Right.
So like every day you're figuring that out, because it is a plein air workshop and makes a big difference if, you know, what's going to happen with the weather.
That's true. I mean, that's a good idea to do that, go prior to the workshop, but I don't know if I have the liberties and flexibility to take that much time off. I wish I did. But different weather situations, like that's a good point that you brought up. Like, you never know what you're going to get. Like, I remember teaching a workshop in Sedona, and wow, the weather's crazy over there. So it was like it changes back and forth from cloudy to sunny constantly. And it was like a real struggle to try to like talk to a demo when everything was changing. And so I thought like, well, why don't I just do like, you know, two panels at once, like two little small panels, and then just paint when it's overcast so I can continue, you know, and stay in the momentum of the demo. Wow. And then when the sun comes out, then I just go to the other panel. I mean, that would be the easiest way to handle that kind of lighting situation.
Okay, we're just going to call you Miss Monet. 15 different panels laying on the ground and you're picking them up, right?
Well, because the students might get like frustrated if I'm sitting there like looking at my watch waiting for the sun to come out. So, you know, because you want to keep the light consistent to what you're doing, to your original plan. So I thought that was a good way to go about it. But so far, you know, other than Sedona, I haven't really come up with that kind of really radical changing weather. It's you know, in California, it's pretty consistent. It's like sunny like all year.
Poor thing.
I know. It's hot. But, and then if it's, if the unusual case of, like, really severe weather, we'll go inside, and I'll have the students either paint from photo reference that they bring from their home or whatever, and I'll still basically cover the same, you know, topics and stuff, but that's I think that happened very few times. And even if the weather's a little bit rainy, like if it's misty, I'll still go out, because it's like, you know, plein air, you know, you kind of have to deal with what nature dishes out. And if it's manageable, you know, I mean, I'm not going to take them out in a blizzard, but if it's manageable, it's nice to get like an experience, like different types of weather conditions, because they can kind of see like, oh, now I could learn how to mix neutrals in this overcast weather, and of course, course, overcast, the light stays really consistent, so they can really take their time and have fun with their exercises and not feel rushed with the rapidly changing light and the sunlight. So it's nice to kind of experience different weather conditions. And also, if it's not blazing hot, you know, they're a little bit more comfortable, and that's like the most important thing, is that they stay comfortable and hydrated. And, you know, I don't want people having heat strokes. And, you know, so just comfort, you know, is important. But yeah, if it's like really severe, of course, I'll take them inside.
Yeah. So when you're planning a workshop, like you said, you were talking about values, and you have a few nice little tools that you give out, like the value comp, you know, so that they can actually hold the little, some people call it red square or whatever, up, so that they can take the color out and actually see the values. That's one thing that you concentrate on, and then naturally drawing. Is there any other particular art skills that you hone into when you're working on your workshops and figuring out what you're going to be talking about?
Well, I break up the workshop in like three major parts, and like, the first couple of days, or the first days, like I talk about design and composition and value. I mean, they're all kind of interrelated anyways. And then the second part I get into is color, because like color theory is like, they have like, that I could talk about that forever, and you can have like a year-long workshop on color. So I try to give the information in a very kind of informal, basic. You know, talk about like primary colors and tertiary colors, how to mix greens, how to make grays and stuff like that. I don't want to throw too much technical stuff in their direction, because they're just going to like look at me blankly and like, you know. But color is important, so you do have to touch on that. Mm-hmm. And then you know, towards the end of the workshop, I get more into like technique, using a different like tools like palette knife and just different brushes to create different effects. But that's not really that important, because to me it's more about like how to structure a painting properly and get the right initial plan, so you can really enjoy the process of plein air painting and just blocking in a good design. And it's not about like finishing, you know, a masterpiece. It's more about like, how do I structure my painting so it reads well. And you know, the students really enjoy the exercises. They seem very simplistic, but in the long run they enjoy the process. And it's something that they can handle, and they feel a little bit more comfortable with the aspect of plein air painting. It's not so daunting.
Well, when you think about it, everything that you just mentioned that you focus on are things that you need to focus on whether you're painting plein air or painting in your studio.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, those color notes that you first put down on your canvas, whether you're standing outside or standing in your studio and painting, are the most important. They have to be right, you know, or else the rest of the painting isn't going to be right. So
yeah, I mean, even in the studio, I mean, I'll approach my paintings the same way. I'll always do like a little value comp prior to doing a painting. If I want to do like a larger piece, then I'll just do that and then use a little color comp. And then, but I still kind of follow the same process as I would plein air painting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I want to take a second and remind our listeners that have tuned in to, if you have any questions for Jennifer, to please type them in on the right on that little webinar, like control panel, I think is what Sherry called it. So go ahead and type things in. Sherry will be taking notes and marking the questions that we'll be asking here in a little while. But I just wanted to remind you all, because we're getting further along into the webinar, and I might forget to remind you, so go ahead and do that. Jennifer, back to you. How do you manage participants that have a wide range of skills? So you could have somebody that's an absolute beginner, maybe doesn't even know how to set up their plein air easel, all the way up to somebody who's taken with you before or taken with other master artists and, you know, are studying with you because they like your particular style or your color choices or something like that. So how do you handle that range to make sure that everybody feels like they've gotten something from your workshop?
Well, the exercises that I provide, you know, they apply both to beginners and experienced painters. And usually, like at the, during the orientation, I ask the students to say what it is that they expect out of a workshop. If it's something like with composition that they have an issue with, or color, so that way I can have an idea of what to address when I'm doing their individual one-on-one critique. Mm-hmm. And usually they'll tell me beforehand too. I like to communicate with the students before the workshop. I send emails, I'll send them like a materials list, a supplies list, and I just kind of like, I just want to get to know them before I actually see them. So a lot of times they'll tell me what level they're at. Sometimes, you know, that they even have different mediums that they want to switch and or try. Sometimes a lot of students will come in and do watercolors or acrylics, which is fine. But that really helps me to kind of get an idea of where they're at, so I can know what to focus on. And and I've also structured the workshop exercises to make them really enjoyable and challenging for the beginners and advanced students. So, you know, the more advanced students don't get bored and the beginners don't get overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. And then the majority of the students really fall within the range of beginning to intermediate. Mm-hmm. And they're really fun to teach too, because they just come in and they're just open-minded and ready to go, and just like they're like sponges, ready to just take any information. And it's really neat, especially when they get like aha moments during the workshop. I really love that feeling. and also what I do is a lot of times if I'm giving a one-on-one instruction to a particular student in the field, I encourage the other students to come by and listen in, you know, mm-hmm. if they feel like taking a break, or if it's something that they overhear that they might need to listen to, or if it's a problem that they're struggling with, like, oh, so I always encourage them to really come by and listen in on the critique that I'm giving to the student. So that mm-hmm. is really helpful too.
I was just going to say that it always interests me when students come in, and of course they're very, very nervous at the beginning. It's like, oh gosh, I'm gonna be painting with Jennifer, and she's so good, and you know, everybody goes through that, you know, that nervous thing as, oh, I hope she doesn't think that I really can't paint, you know, all those fears that we all have, no matter, you know, who we're taking or studying from or whatever. So you have those, you got to put those fears at ease, and I think contacting them beforehand, so that they get to know you a little bit is a really good thing to do.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're all nervous. I mean, even I'm nervous because, we're all learning all the time. But it's, you know, meeting new people, and I don't know what to expect. So it's just, you know, I kind of let them know, too, that it's like, you know, we're all in this together. And I think the more camaraderie and kind of a comfortable, warm atmosphere there is, the more comfortable they'll be, and the more likely they'll learn more from the workshop and really enjoy it.
Yeah, there's, you know, a number of workshops that are very memorable to me that I have taken, and it's, you know, basically the people that I studied with during that week, you know, have made some memorable times, and also, you know, how close the teacher has gotten, the instructor has gotten to know us, certainly adds to that and benefits that experience as well. So, you know, having taken from a number of folks, and then also having worked with Kevin on help him administer, you know, his workshops, it's, mm-hmm. you know, really kind of interesting, because I think there's one thing that one instructor does, and I absolutely love it. Every time he asks the question, and he'll say, you know, who here thinks they're going to leave with 5 finished paintings? And everybody's hands shoot up. And he goes, okay, well, we're going to get rid of that expectation right now. So do you have that expectation that people are going to walk away with a great painting, or is it, we're here to learn, I don't even want you to, you know, go there and think that you're going to get this finished painting, but you're going to get something that looks really cool?
Well, but that's a good question. But for me, I kind of want them to come in and just do a lot of, as much painting as they can. A lot of, which is why I like to keep the format small. Like on my supplies list, I ask them to bring panels like no larger than 8x10, and you know, so 8x10 or smaller. because there's so many different elements you're dealing with, a changing light. And I find that if you do small, little, manageable paintings, you're not so vested in them. And if you screw up, like, just take another one and start over. So it's just it's all about learning, because it's like they're going through this whole learning curve where they're getting all this new information and they're processing it, and they're going to be slower at their regular way of painting because it's new to them. So it's better to just keep the exercises really simple, and they really enjoy it. They have a lot of fun that way. So I just expect them to just really come in with an open mind and just try to really get a lot of brush mileage as much as they can. Make mistakes. It's okay, because you learn from your mistakes, and not, you know, be so like, oh, I just wasted paint, and, you know, and also use a lot of paint and they squeeze out these lids.
I have that with my students and that I teach inside down at the Art Center. It's, you know, mm-hmm. I say, you know, okay, you know, lay out your palette, you know, and they squeeze out one drip of of color, you know, for each color that they have on their palette, and I'm like, really? Come on, squeeze this stuff out. So it's really kind of interesting to see, you know, to see that. And it happens everywhere I've gone to teach. It has happened that, you know, folks don't want to use up their whole tube of paint. And,
you know, it's understandable. You know, supplies are expensive.
Tube.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
You know.
But more than a trip.
So. Oh, and another thing I was tell them is to just, like, not be so hard on themselves, because a lot of times that's so important, you know, just like, you know, every student has their own personality and things like that. So, but the main thing is just to, like, you know, really not be so harsh. Just go in, have fun, and just, yeah. Because when you have that kind of like pent up anxiety, then it makes it a little bit more difficult to enjoy the workshop and actually to even learn. So,
So in your conversations, either at the beginning when you're emailing them prior mm-hmm. to the workshop, or in the introduction part where they, you know, tell a little bit about themselves and their work, do you try to extract from them what their goal is from studying with you? Or you don't want to know, we're going to do this by the seat of the pants. So.
Well, it depends on what their goals are, which mm-hmm. is why I have them do the round robin. So then a particular student might really want to focus and stress on composition. So when I go and do the individual critique in the field, then we'll talk mostly about that, and I'll kind of assist them in helping them, you know, deal with like issues with composition, and same with color or value, because everyone has strengths and weaknesses that they bring. So I like to kind of help them, you know, break through the bad habits of their weaknesses, and then also really emphasize their strengths and make sure to point that out, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's good. I mean, we all do have, typically what I've found is, you know, me either being in a workshop or conducting a workshop and having, you know, students there, everyone really does, whether they know it or not, have goals that they want to accomplish. They may not have just thought about it so, you know, succinctly, but there are things that they end up, you know, wanting to accomplish when they're at the workshop. And then the other question I have for you is, do you have a set of like handouts that you hand out on the specific topic, or do you just, I know these things, so it's very easy for you to talk about them, mm-hmm. but, you know, are there handouts that you hand out? Should there be handouts that you hand out to the group? What's your feeling?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think it's a good idea. I mean, for me, I like to be like uber prepared before a workshop, because that helps me teach a little bit more easier, so I do have handouts for each student. It's a little packet, and there's different notes and little illustrations on compositions, and there's all sorts of stuff, but just kind of like very short, concise little notes. It's not a whole booklet, but just on topics that I'll be covering. So sometimes on the first day, I'll have them, if they have a chance, sometimes if they're too tired, they don't, but I ask them to kind of peruse over the notes a little bit on, you know, the night of, and then so they can kind of like, you know, ingest some of that information, because most of the stuff I'll be like repeating over and over again anyways in their notes. But if they kind of read the notes beforehand, like on the first night, then it gives them that more, you know, of an edge. But yeah, I provide the notes, and usually in the notes, depending on where, what workshop I do, I provide maps, phone numbers for emergencies, and a little complimentary viewfinder, and then a little value strip, because I work with a four value system, and that has little holes in each value block so they can kind of compare the color when they hold up the strip. So that those two things are really important to have during the workshop. So I have that for them. And then, of course, I'll bring extra stuff. You know, sometimes I'll bring extra easels, because you never know, somebody might, you know, lose it on the flight or it might break or whatnot. And I'll bring extra Gamsol for people who are traveling by air, and extra paints, because, you know, you never know. So, and, of course, extra panels. Somebody might run out of panels, so I'll always have extra panels for them to use. So I just want them to be prepared and just have all the stuff they need for the workshop, because there's nothing worse than, like, not having enough stuff or running out of things or things breaking. It really kind of doesn't make it fun.
Yeah.
You know? It can be frustrating for the student.
Yeah, well, one thing I'm going to do is I'm going to go off of our little question list, but you'll be able to answer this, because I just know you will. And I want to actually just say, hi, Ben. Because I know he's listening.
No, he's not here. Is that
he's not? Oh, yeah. He left? Oh, okay. Well, tell him I said hi.
Yeah, I
but,
will.
But I wanted to talk about the fact that Ben is a great assistant to you, especially at workshops, because he kind of, you know, keeps you on track, and it's a good thing if you can have that ability to have someone there that will be kind of an assistant for you, right? I mean,
oh, absolutely. Yeah,
yeah.
He's a blessing. I mean, it's just lovely to have him there at the workshop, because I miss him when I'm away from him. But he kind of, he is my assistant, and he'll kind of like handle like non-artistic needs for the students. Like, let's say there's a student who brought a brand new easel. She never opened it before. She's having trouble putting it together. He will do that. And if it's like a very hot climate, you know, he'll go around handing out chilled water bottles to the students. So, you know, making sure everyone's comfortable. So that helps me too, because then I can be more focused on teaching and instructing, rather than like worrying about all these other little things that might take up time and tire me out. So it's really, really nice to have him there.
So if you can, you know, bring along a friend who doesn't necessarily, I'm not talking about as a student, I'm talking being the instructor. That's all Jennifer needs, is everybody to bring a friend, right?
So. And also, just in case I sleep in, well, that never happened, but, you know, he's kind of like my alarm clock. It's like, Jennifer, wake up. You got a workshop to teach.
Slave driver.
Exactly.
Yeah, so, you know, if you are thinking about offering workshops and you want to instruct and things like that, you know, maybe, you know, just ask a friend to come and be, you know, Ben, hand out the water and, you know, make sure everybody's having a good time. And Ben is great. If you've never met Jennifer's Ben, which actually Tom and I, by the way, Tom and I call you Benifer.
That's okay. I've heard it
back here. Yeah,
so many times.
I know. But
it's okay.
Nothing unusual. Nothing new about that one. But anyway,
right.
You know, Ben has a great sense of person and a great sense of humor and things like that. So he'll actually keep you laughing and things. So, you know, an assistant isn't something that necessarily, if you're throwing your first workshop, that you think about, but after you throw that first workshop, you're going to be, boy, I wish I would have had, you know, this extra set of hands and this person to kind of keep me on track and things like that. It works out really, really well. So just a little
I mean, it's just also the you know, plein air workshops, it's a little bit different as opposed to like teaching indoors. It's a little bit more controlled. I might be able to do it by myself if I was teaching in a studio environment, because everyone's there together. And but the plein air, you know, everyone's spread out, and I have to run from student to student. And then, so, and also he keeps track of who is where. so and lets me know so I don't miss on seeing someone or talking to someone in the afternoon. Because I like to see each, like during the afternoon session of their painting, I like to see them at least, you know, two times, three if I can, depending on how large the class is. But, you know, during the beginning process of their painting, and then the middle stage and then the end stage. So, but it's a lot of work. You know, I try to really give as much time and attention to each person that they need. So, you know, with him letting me know, like, who I miss and stuff like that, it kind of keeps the workshop running a little bit smoothly and a little bit more organized.
Right. So I want to step back a second to something you mentioned when we were talking about the skills and techniques and what you focus on and things like that. And you mentioned the four value system, which I know what that is because we talked about it, and I'm sure most people do, but you basically want to limit your students to use four values. Is that correct?
Yes.
And can you give us a little reason why?
It keeps the design a little bit more simple. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, when you're out in the field, you know, you're looking at your scene and you're basically going to be seeing millions of values. So keeping it to four value system helps you to break the major shapes and simplify your pattern. So light and dark patterns. So you're better able to kind of construct a nice, concise, simple, strong design. And it's basically like editing, you know. Mm-hmm. Whereas an area might have like four very closely related or three closely related values, you kind of have to edit and make it one. It just keeps the design plan a little bit more simple and helps them to break down all these little broken shapes a little bit more concisely. I don't know if that makes sense.
But. Yeah, it does. Typically, I don't want to say an arrow, but an arrow because it's not really. It's just how we're trained to see growing up or whatever is to always go to the detail. Always go to the detail. You know, and all of the time, typically, it's like everybody wants to paint every leaf on the tree when it's like, no, that's a big shape. Don't paint the leaves, and when you'll find out when you're sitting there painting the leaves that typically what you'll end up doing is changing a value before you change a color because right. You're getting down to a very, very small detail, and next thing you know, you have all these values all over the place, and you lose that strong feel for the painting. Staying in four values, if you just used the four values from white to black, if you will, and paint it that way, again, like Ansel Adams, when his black and white photography is, you see the strength of the design so much quicker with that four. Yeah. So
yeah, I mean, it just simplifies. It just simplifies a complex scene because it's like it's very mm-hmm. overwhelming. There's a lot of information going on, so you have to kind of like, okay, how am I going to handle this? And so and that's why I have them do a black and white exercise every time, like before they actually go into color. And on the first day, actually, I have them do just black and white exercises. And sometimes, depending on the student, one might enjoy the exercise so much that, you know, she or he will tell me like, oh, I'm going to do value for the rest of the workshop. so I'm not opposed to that. You know, I do want them to do some of the other stuff, the color, but if that's something that they really feel that they need to work on, then that's fine too. It just helps to get the general light and dark pattern and it just, so you can translate that clearly into a painting. So,
but it's such an aha when somebody gets that, you know, that value thing by doing the black and white values, and when it finally clicks, it's such an aha to see it. I've seen it so many times, and they feel like they've accomplished so much, and it's a great moment for both the instructor and the student. I think when that happens, it's just so cool.
And of course, squinting. Squinting is very important.
Yes,
I they hear that a lot. Squint, squint, squint. That's like, of course, that'll help you to break down the values into four. But that's a huge factor. Squint. Yeah.
So, as an instructor, and this is going to be like, we'll go into talking about what workshops and things you have coming up here after this question. But as an instructor, what expectations do you have of your students?
let's see. Well, I expect them to, like I said earlier before, to approach the class like with an open mind, ready to learn, and just leave any like preconceived ideas on the door so they can, you know, benefit fully from the workshop. Of course, not to be hard on themselves, and see the workshop as an opportunity to, you know, to harness and adapt new skills, mm-hmm. you know, for successfully painting on plein air, and not like come in expecting to go home with like two masterpieces. That's not the main focus of the workshop. And then also, of course, to have fun and be relaxed. And to actually do the exercises that I tell them to do. And also to, of course, to be respectful of each other and not monopolize, you know, the other students' time and stuff like that. And to ask a lot of questions. I tell them, like, just ask me as many questions as you like. You know, I'm there for them. You know, I love sharing my information, and so, you know, whatever, you know, question they have, like, I just, you know, really emphasize that they ask me questions as much as they can, and especially if there's something that they're unsure or confused about. I don't want them to, like, you know, be shy and like, oh, I'm not going to ask her that, and then leave the workshop with this ambiguous kind of concept. So, and then also to be clear about what they need from the workshop. That's like, and usually that's kind of like the orientation where I kind of get an idea of that, and of course to make sure they have like all the materials they need, like to be prepared. That's really important too, because it's like sometimes they'll show up and they're missing brushes, or they have the wrong type of brushes, or there's not enough paints, or they got the wrong colors that, you know, that are not listed on the list, and so that just makes it a little bit more kind of frustrating for the student during the workshop. So I just want to make sure that they're all prepared and have everything that they need so the workshop can run smoothly for both me and them.
Right. Sounds good. Anything else that
expectations? I expect them to bring me dark chocolate.
There you go. I knew there was something.
I know, right?
Right,
I just have to put that in.
Yeah, yeah. I knew there was one more thing. So that's, I think that your list of expectations doesn't really, you know, deter or travel any off the beaten path of most of the other instructors that I've, you know, talked with and things like that. And I think, you know, if you go in like with, like Jennifer was talking about, with an open mind and, you know, with the mindset that you're there to learn, not there to create something, you know, wonderful that you're going to hang on your wall. Hopefully by the end of the week you may be able to do that, but, you know, at least earlier on really learn about the concepts and the things that they're trying to teach you. I think having that open mind is really, really key. So
totally.
Yeah, yeah. So most important part. So I want to actually talk a little bit about the workshops that you have coming up.
Okay.
But let's do that by leading in with, so, you know, a lot of folks may be doing a lot of the workshops here in the States, and they want to, you know, stretch out and go overseas and teach a workshop. And I know that you've got a couple of overseas workshops coming up, one specifically in South Africa. So why don't you talk a little bit about how those happen? Because you can really get burned doing an overseas workshop if you're not watching, you know, how much it's going to cost you to get there, how much it's going to cost the panel, you know, the students to get there. You know, you may not make money unless you do something. So when we talked about this over the phone, you had a very specific thing that has happened that, you know, makes it, you know, it's going to be okay. So
yeah.
So talk about that a little bit.
For the South Africa workshop, I was approached by Linda Hodnett, and very lovely lady, and she's a managing editor of the South African magazine. And she actually contacted me through Facebook. She sent me a message, and she's like, "Hey, would you like to teach in South Africa?" I'm like, "Yeah, you know, that's kind of cool." But typically, you know, it's funny because I'm going to bring Ben in again. I usually pass it through the Ben. Like if somebody approaches me with a venue to go teach at, you know, I have him look over the contract and all that stuff that he deals with, and you know, he can kind of give me an idea of whether it's worth it to go or if it's not going to be problematic, if they're well organized. And also I kind of look and see if how long they've been doing it, you know, whatever venue invites me, if they've been doing it for a while, they have great testimonials from other students. That really helps a lot too, to just, agree and like, yeah, I'll do the workshop with you guys. So I'm really excited about this one coming up. And then the one for Provence, that was through Jackie Grandchamp, who organizes the French Escapade Tours. And actually, Kaiko Tanabe, a wonderful watercolor artist, beautiful work, she actually recommended me to Jackie. So Jackie contacted me, and, I felt more comfortable knowing that Kaiko taught there, because she's a very respected painter, and looked at Jackie's website, and she's been doing it for a while. She's extremely organized. Her itineraries are really tight and very, she takes people to beautiful places, and very organized. So I figured, okay, you know, because the more organized they are, the less stress I have, and we're, you know, less things to worry about. I can just show up and teach, and, So it all depends on if it's reputable place and if they have good reviews and stuff like that, and
and the good thing about someone contacting you, which you mm-hmm. should do due diligence and check them out before, like you said, signing any contract and looking them out, like you said, is that they actually have, you know, an email list or followers that they'll say, "Hey, we've got Jennifer McChristian coming over here, and she's going to teach, and here's some of her work." And you're not then responsible for taking 10 or 15 people from the United States to South Africa. You may actually be teaching people who actually live in South Africa who want to paint like you. So there's a big difference between bringing people with you to go paint in that area versus having people that are your contacts there who have contacts, who have a following, that you will end up like creating, you know, you're actually expanding your base of people around the world who know about your art. So
totally.
Yeah, so that's one of the things to check out. And of course, you know, in the day of internet and scams and all that kind of stuff, like Jennifer was saying, you know, do your due diligence and really check them out before you sign anything. So
yeah.
Yeah,
I apologize about this sound in the back. To doing construction on our property, so if you hear that bad. Okay.
I don't, but I just looked out my window. It looks like somebody may be cutting the grass here, sort of shortly.
Oh,
so,
okay.
So we'll probably between the construction, it'll be really interesting. So, I'm not saying, and I also guess I want to make sure too that, you know, I'm not saying that you can't organize your own trip and take the people over there. Just, you know, just be aware of your finances, your economic model that you're doing that with, so that you can make sure that you don't lose money on that.
Oh, of course. Yeah, you want to make it worth it for you as well as the students. And I mean, I organize my own workshop when I do the OHAI, when I've been teaching in OHAI for like, I think, 7 years, I think, or 8 years. Mm-hmm. So that entails a little bit more work because I'm doing all the paperwork and the receipts and the registration. I'm doing all that myself, whereas the other venues, they do all that. And then I just show up and teach.
Well, I could ask you which one you prefer, but I think I know.
I like all of them. I like the OHAI one a lot because I'm familiar with it, so it goes a little bit more smoother. And the other ones is just, of course, it's exciting to go to new places. And I've been, you know, a lot of time I've been contacted from different places to teach, in Europe. And a lot of times I had to decline only because of schedule conflicts and stuff like that. So, I have to try to manage, my time as to, how flexible I can be leaving, taking time off during the year. And also Ben comes along with me, so he's got to consider, you know, taking time off his work. So mm-hmm. I try to limit the workshops to, a maximum of 4 a year. Even 4 a year is a lot for me because I want to mm-hmm. focus on other stuff too and studio shows and stuff. But 4 is a good number. You know, I like mm-hmm. to do spring, summer, and then fall.
Okay. How many students is the ideal number of students?
I like 12, a maximum of 12. That's a nice okay. number. Maybe for the overseas, you know, 10 is more comfortable because there's a lot more entailed and a lot more stuff. You're going around different cities and all that stuff. And but usually 12 is good. And not any more than that. However, I am going to be teaching in South Africa. I'm going to be teaching 2 workshops back to back, and I'll have like about maybe a week in between each workshop. And both of them are like 15 students. One of them is sold out, and I think another one has like 4 spaces left. But that's a lot of students. So I really I'll have to prepare myself.
Okay, so we talked a little bit about South Africa that you've got coming up, and you have Provence, and so are those the only 2 that you have?
No, actually, I have also, of course, my Ojai workshop, which I will be doing in, I always do my Ojai workshop in April. It's a nice time of the year to do it, mm-hmm. And that's going to be in 2017. I haven't listed the dates yet on my website, but I will be doing that. Probably like early August, mid-August at the latest. I'll have all my dates on there. I do have the dates for the Provence. That's up and ready to go, and there's a button there you can click on if you want to register. All the information is on there. And then I also have a workshop in – we're still working out logistics for that, but I do have a workshop in Nantucket that's going to be in September 2017. And, okay. of course, I'll have the information for that as well on my website very, very soon. And then, of course, the Big Sur workshop, which I teach at Esalon. I would say that's one of my favorite places to teach. Is that what you were saying?
No, I just know that you have done that. I couldn't remember the name of the place. I've been there, but I couldn't remember the name of the place. I mean, I haven't been there for your workshop. I think we drove by it, and we may have eaten. I think there's a restaurant there or something that we may have eaten.
Oh, near the it's such a beautiful area.
Yeah, it is. But talk about that one, because that is a nice one.
Yeah, that one. I've been teaching at the Esalen Institute for about 6 years. I'm so bad with time. It goes by so fast. I lose track. I love it there. They're very, very organized. They run a tight ship. They teach all sorts of workshops throughout the year. And I like to either go in June or October, but since I'll be in Provence for next year around that time, I'm switching it to October, which is a lovely time to go to because they have a butterfly migration, and also mm-hmm. the weather is much better than June. It's actually more clear. In June, they have a lot of like overcast mornings and stuff, but in October, it's actually nice and warm. The skies are always clear, so I'm excited to be teaching in October. That's going to be, 2017 October. Again, also, I'm still working on the dates for that, and I will have all that finalized on my website very soon.
Is in the Big Sur, in case folks don't know where that is.
Big Sur. It's a really lovely place, and you know the nice thing about that particular location is that you have the beautiful mineral hot springs to enjoy after you paint, and they have the best masseuse therapist, so you can get a massage after a hard day of painting. And they have, like, you know, the cafeteria there that they serve 3 meals a day. So that makes it a little bit easier because then, you know, a lot of the other workshops, you kind of have to go out and get lunch. So you kind of feel a little bit rushed because you want to get back and paint. So, this particular location, they have 3 meals provided a day. And then, it's a lot more relaxed atmosphere. And again, the more relaxed you are, then the better I teach, and the more the students, you know, enjoy the experience and all that stuff. And it's close, too. It's relatively close, so I don't have to deal with flying and stuff. It's just pretty much like a 5.5-hour drive, 6 hours. But the way Ben drives, I would say 5. Yeah, I know. But yeah, so those are the four, like Ojai in April, and then Provence late May, early June, Nantucket September 2017, and then Big Sur Esalen in October 2017. Again, I'll have all the dates set up on there by mid-August. And just to put it out there, if you're not on my newsletter, email, contact list, you can always go on my website and click on the newsletter icon, and then you can just subscribe. And then I send newsletters out, you know, probably like five times a year, and then people can be updated about like the workshops that are coming up, if I updated any shows, whatnot. So so that's a good way to also be in the know. Like if once I get all my dates up, I can just send a newsletter, say, hey, all the dates are up and you can register, blah, blah, blah. So if you're not on my newsletter contact list, then yeah, just do that.
And your website is jennifermcchristian.com?
Yeah, and then there's like a little tab at the top that says about and all that, and then you click on newsletter, and then that'll come up with a pop-up window that has like, you know, your information, and then you just hit subscribe.
Okay, well, we're going to go into our questions from our audience now. So, Sherry, if you want to unmute yourself. And Jennifer, thank you so much for all of your insights so far.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so Sherry, you ready?
I sure am. Thank you so much, Jennifer. This has been so fascinating. We've gotten some great questions. Some of them are about your like teaching workshops and organizing them, and some are about your painting process. So I thought we would start with the workshop-specific questions.
Okay.
One just came in from Patricia, and it's, what is your process in negotiating payment when you're asked to teach for an organization?
Could you repeat that again?
Sure, yeah, sorry. It's, what's your process for negotiating payment when you're asked to teach for an organization?
Oh, if, like somebody approaches me to teach a workshop?
Yeah,
sure.
How do you get to your, what you get paid and what you need?
That would be a Ben thing. I mean, that would be a Ben thing to see. That's why he's my assistant. So I have him, you know, pretty much look over the contract and all that stuff. And even if he needs to contact the organizer and talk to them and negotiate, that would be him. I mean, I wish I could share more about that. I'd leave that up to him. I just worry about what colors I'm going to mix.
Like, do you know if there's a specific, like, percentage where, you know, it would be, like, a make-or-break deal for you? Like, I have no idea. Like, 50%. Like, I'll just throw that out there. Or if you don't have that, that's okay, too.
Well, I think it depends on you know, if it's worth it to go out there and take time off, and you want to be able to make some money back and stuff like that. So, you know, whereas the other venues don't pay as much, but it's they have other perks. So, you know, like Esalen and stuff has all these other factors that you can enjoy. I mean, all of them are enjoyable, but it also it depends on you know, the time, if it's worth to go out there and how much I'm getting back and, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, that's good. And I think probably as long as, like, for the person who would be organizing their own workshops, like, it would be if it's worth it to them, basically, right? And there's always, I'm sure there's always room for negotiations.
Yeah, you basically, you start out with looking at what your expenses will be. If you have to travel to teach or instruct the workshop, you want to make sure that you get money above what your travel expenses are.
Yeah.
You know, things like that are the considerations that you need, you know, how much in supplies are you going to be bringing out? You know, is it going to be an extra charge because you have to fly with an extra, you know, suitcase? So take all of those into consideration.
And renting a
vehicle. Where you're going to stay. All those expenses, and then you want to make money above that. So typically, you know, I would say if they come out with a 50-50 split, you really have to pay attention to your expenses. If they do a 50-50 split and then they turn around and say, and you're responsible for your expenses, you know, you may be looking at only making a 5%, you know, profit on there, and then is that worth your time? Now, if they offer you somewhere around 60 to 70%, you pay your own expenses, you know, you may be looking at, you know, possibly 30% that you get to keep yourself. So, so you just need to take into all those things, just, you know, write them all down, add them all up, and figure out whether or not it's worth it to you.
Great. That's great advice.
That's
Thank you.
That's a good point. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. The next one is sort of like a two or three part question. Cedar asks, how do you find students who are interested in an international workshop? And along the same note, where would you advertise for something like that?
For one, I use my newsletter as a way to advertise my workshops. And then I'll also post it on Oil Painters of America has a little workshop listing that you can, post your workshop on there with the dates and all that stuff and a link that goes through all the information. It's like just like $20 or something, and it's up for 6 months. And of course, through Facebook, you can do like a invite. I've considered ads and stuff, but I haven't done that yet. Like maybe in Planner Magazine, maybe I'll do that at some point. But those are pretty much the sources that I kind of utilize to put it out there. I'll do also little postcards. I have at the studio, and if anyone's interested in workshop or stuff, give them the postcard. But I try to put it out there as much as I can.
Excellent. And then along the same note, if someone was like going to try to find an international organization that would sponsor or host a workshop, do you have any advice for going about that?
Oh, I'm sorry, you just broke up a little bit. Could you repeat that again?
Oh, sorry. Sure. Okay. So if someone wanted to organize, if they wanted to teach an international workshop, do you have any advice for how they would find, cold calling? Do you have any idea how they would find a sponsor or a host for that?
Oh, if they actually want to organize it themselves, or if they want to go through somebody
They want
else?
To go. They want to go through the person in the country. They want to find somebody in a country that they want to go to.
Yeah.
Kind of like your contacts that contacted you, reverse that. If you were going to to teach, yeah, got it?
Yeah. Well, there's so many different places that are doing this now, just offering like accommodations, and I don't know how they work out their fees and stuff, but just beautiful locations that offer places for people to come in and teach workshops. Or have lectures or whatnot. So I just see those, pop up every now and then through different websites or, I get emails offering, to offer, opportunity to offer your workshop and so-and-so, whatever. Also through referrals from friends who have taught different places that you're interested in going to. You can also talk to artist friends, and then that way is better because you can get a little bit more information about what their experience was like. But just research online I prefer asking someone who has been to a particular location and has done the workshop there, so at least I know what I'm in for, depending on their experience, mm-hmm. Rather than just like not knowing who the person is. And yeah.
Sherry?
Yeah.
I don't know if Artist Magazine still does this or not, but in the back, like last three pages, gosh, this is probably years ago.
They still do.
They still do. Okay, so in the back of the Artist Magazine, there are people who take out ads and say, come to Sedona or come to France and we'll arrange everything. So with it being in the Artist Magazine, still do your due diligence naturally because they are purchasing an ad, but, at least they knew to go to the Artist Magazine. So
yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Linda. And actually, those workshop listings are also available at artistnetwork.com. I think if you do a search for art workshops, you'll find those. I upload them personally when the issues
come out.
Well,
then that's how you knew.
They're up to date. Great. Moving on, we have some questions about your actual paintings. And one in particular is, this is interesting because you are painting in plein air. Kathy has asked if you could talk a little bit about composition and focal points.
Okay. Let's see, composition. Well, that's basically the first topic that I get into during the workshop. And which is another reason why I have them use their little viewfinders that I provide for them. That's very important. Because of the composition, you're going in the field and you're standing there and you have like this 360 degree view of like all the stuff around you. So that can be quite overwhelming. So I'll talk about ways to hone in on a subject and kind of like put your actual subject matter in a format that you like. And also I also encourage them to do small little thumbnail sketches, like tiny, tiny little thumbnail sketches of different compositional ideas, like maybe something with a low horizon or a high horizon. There's, you know, an Edgar Payne book, which is on my recommended readings list, is a wonderful book. And I always tell them to make sure that if they purchase any book, that would be that one. It's a wonderful, wonderful, informative book on different on concepts on composition and different formats for composition. So that's what I do. And then the focal point, the little viewfinder that I provide for them has like a little golden means grid, which is broken up into quarters. So the little intersecting points are basically ideally the place where you want to put your focal point. And I talk about that too, like different ways to lead your eye, using visual linear cues to bring your eye into the focal point. And also having more than one focal point, but making one more dominant than the other. So I hope that answered the question.
I think it's a good start to a very complex.
That was easy for me to like show them. Yeah, you're welcome.
The next question is, I'm gonna combine a couple. One person, Susan, has asked if you use palette knives along with your brushes. And then along the same note, Hillary has asked if you're willing to talk about your color palette and what type of brushes you prefer.
Oh, absolutely. I do use a combination of like my brush and the palette knife. I use my palette knife a lot when I'm mixing my colors, because that way it keeps the colors clean. With a lot of times, you know, people dip their brush into the solvent and then start mixing with a dirty brush, and because all these ask me, like, how do you keep your colors so clean? So if you're not washing your brush regularly or wiping off the paint that's on there when you're mixing a new color, you're going to start polluting those nice, brilliant, beautiful colors that you want to mix, and then it's going to turn into mud, and it's not going to have that vibrancy that you're looking for. So I mix a lot with my palette knife prior to, well, first, you know, I figure out, like, what value is going to be, what color. And then once I get the exact color and value and temperature and intensity that I want, then I'll go ahead and use my brush to block in, you know, the shape or whatever. Once in a blue moon, I'll mix with my, if I'm like in the zone and I'm painting and I'm just on momentum, I'll use my brush a little bit if it's like a small little area. But typically when the beginning stages, when I'm working in all the bigger shapes, I like to use my palette knife because that forces me to use more paint. Because the worst thing is like when you're not using enough paint, and then you have to figure out like, oh shoot, how did I mix that color? And it's better to just have an ample amount of paint, so you're not, you know, your focus and process is not broken up, and you know, when you're in the zone especially. So, and I also like to use a palette knife for other little things like scraping things and doing like little lines, like small little fine lines. You can scrape off the wet paint and have the canvas show through. And if you want to do like a really thick impasto edge, you know, I like to use that, the palette knife for that too. But that's mostly like the technical aspect of the workshop, which comes in later. I use it mostly for like mixing my big batches of color.
Okay.
And you want me to go into the other question about the brushes and the color palette?
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay, and the color palette is a limited palette, and it's basically a titanium white, a cad yellow medium, cad red, yellow ochre, a phthalo red rose, which is also, you can also get a quinacridone, I can never pronounce it right, quinacridone red, which is the same, and then a cooler red, a alizarin, of course, that's always on the palette, and ultramarine blue. So those are pretty much the colors that I use. And I don't use any black. I mix my own. If I have to mix a really, really dark, intense color, this is during the second day when I do a color swatch demonstration. I'll show them how to mix really beautiful, rich, dark blacks that have a lot of color underneath, because just using straight black will just kind of deaden and kill the intensity of any rich color. And also, they can use, if they have excess dark color left over, they can use that, add white to it, and make some beautiful grays with that too. So there's a ton of colors you can mix. There's just a limited palette. And as far as brushes, I don't know if there's any more, if she has any more questions about the actual color, I couldn't get into, I can get into that too.
Yeah, actually there is, and I didn't want to interrupt you though, but there is a very specific question. It's
okay.
Do you always use your Indian yellow and permanent rose tone, or are there certain situations, such as a gray day, when you would not tone your support with the Indian yellow and permanent rose?
Regardless of the weather or the atmospheric light, I always use that tone. And yeah, that's a good question. That is a combination of the phthalo red rose and the Indian yellow, which I use a little bit. I put those on my palette, and then I kind of scrub it in with a slightly wet paper towel, and I just kind of brush it into the panel, because you don't want it to be too wet, because then it's going to pick up some of that color that you put on top. So when I paint, I pretty much just like kind of place the color down without blending on my canvas too much, because again, that keeps the colors clean, and it's more direct, and it's more efficient. You know, once you get your color right, you put it down, you leave it alone. But I always stain it with that kind of salmon-y, beautiful kind of rosy color that I really like, and I think it really kind of unifies the painting, and I like showing little areas peeking through that kind of gives it a warm glow. But yeah, that's the combination of Indian yellow and a phthalo red rose. And I rarely use those two colors throughout the whole painting process, unless I'm mixing let's say I want to intensify if I'm doing a bougainvillea, and I want to do like a number two value scale of a rich pink without adding too much white, because white will kind of cool down the color and dull in it, so you want to keep that intensity of that beautiful rose. Maybe I'll use like a straight cad red and then put in a little bit of the phthalo red rose to give that rosy, pretty color without affecting the value or making it chalky or too dark. Yeah, but those two colors, yeah, is what I use for the base. And I always, regardless of the lighting situation, I will always use the same tone, because it works either way. It works for a bright sunny day with shadows and nice muted grays and overcast weather.
Perfect. And then your favorite brushes?
My favorite brushes, I like to use the, I get them at the Dick Blick Art Store. They're Master Stroke with a black handle, hog bristle, and I like to use flats and brights, pretty much. Once in a while, I'll throw in a round, but I rarely use rounds, mostly flats and brights, and ranging from a number 4 size, which is the smallest, to like a number 10, or maybe even a 12. They're inexpensive. They're not like hardcore, you know, fancy brushes, but they work for what I'm doing, and I take really, really good care of my brushes. I clean them consistently after each painting session, and I put a little bit of that conditioner on the bristles to keep the shape nice and square. So I mean, I figure if you take good care of your supplies, and you know, they'll take good care of you. You know, I'm really good about that. I'm really good about that. Almost to the point where it's like obsessive compulsive, but I love working with a nice crisp edge of a brush. And once they start getting all frayed and just kind of split up at the ends, I kind of just toss them, or I'll keep them in my old brushes canister, and maybe I might use them in the studio if I want to like scumble in a really area roughly without having to worry about like ruining my brushes. So they do come in handy for other stuff, but when I'm doing plein air, I like to have like a nice brush with good hairs on it, and and the Signet, I think, Robert Simmons, those are nice too. They have a nice bounce to the bristle, but those pretty much are the two brands that I use. But yeah, just mostly flats and brights. And then I also use a small little filbert, like a number two filbert, that I call my pencil brush. And that's basically, once I get the stain onto the canvas, then I use that to block in, like a, almost like a construction line, block in or drawing of my major shapes, rather than just drawing it in with a pencil or whatever. I just use that as my pencil or, you know, my tool to draw in the basic simple outlines of the major shapes.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Speaking of supplies, we're going to switch gears, going back to the workshop just for a moment.
Okay.
Someone came up with a question I thought was if you have any advice, I think it'll be helpful. She says that many of her workshop students show up without supplies that she has asked them to bring. She says, I end up loaning out my own things, and she wanted to know if you've had this problem, and if so, how you've dealt with it.
That's a good question. That has come up, not frequently, but once in a blue moon, it could be a matter of just their luggage gets lost or something. So, you know, that's unfortunate, stuff like that happens. But, I always make sure, like, before I go to my workshop, I email them, like, insistently, like, just, like, I'm like a mother hen. Like, do you have everything? And I just like, are you all prepared? And did you make sure to get all the blah, blah, blah? So, you know, that kind of, puts the seed in their head to make sure to come to the workshop prepared. But in any case, if they're missing an item or something that's really important, then yeah, that's why I always bring extra stuff. I mean, if I'm driving to a destination, that makes it a lot easier because I've got a big truck, so I can just throw all my shit in there and have extra stuff, extra easels, extra Gamsol, even extra paints. So that's not an issue for me. But I always stress, make sure to check in before the workshop. And months before, and then even when the workshop dates get nearer, I'll email them and say, do you have everything, and blah, blah, blah. It's happened before, and I'll lend out whatever I can. And sometimes some of the other students might have something that I don't that they'll contribute, which is lovely of them to do. But that's pretty much how I handle it.
Hey, include the line. You. Include the line that there are no art supply centers around, and maybe that'll help.
Yeah.
There you go.
The nearest one's now, 5 hours away.
Yeah.
We have another question regarding workshops, and this person wants to know, I think this is interesting, if you keep in touch with the students after workshop by answering questions or putting out new information, and if you use your website or social media. And I'm guessing part of that, they're wanting to know, like, how much additional information and work are you putting into the workshops after the actual workshop is over?
Okay, that's a good question too. Yes, I do keep in touch with my students, and I encourage them to actually keep in touch with me, because once the workshop is over, it's like I always feel sad because you get to know them, you bond with them, and then everyone's gone. So I always encourage them to stay in touch and to let me know what their creative journey is, how it's going, and if they have like a painting that they've done and they want me to critique, I encourage that. They can send me stuff afterward, but I definitely like to keep in touch with them so I can kind of gauge and see how they're doing, and just every now and then to see if they're still doing their value exercises and stuff. And a lot of times they'll contact me and say, I'm still I'm so excited about the things, and I traveled here and I did the value exercises. So it's always nice to hear from them. I definitely suggest definitely keeping in touch. And of course, yeah, through the email and stuff, because once they register with me, then they're automatically on my email newsletter, so they'll get like updates and stuff on new workshops. I get a lot of repeat students too, which is nice too. And I think, did I answer the question fully?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for that. This next one is we have one more quick question, and then I think we'll have an interesting one to wrap up with, and then we'll start to wrap up.
Okay.
Julie has asked if you could just repeat the book that you had recommended earlier in the our chat, because your voice had cut out just a little bit. She missed the title of it. Do you remember which book that was?
Oh, the Edgar Payne book? It's a composition. Let me see. Yeah, it's a
composition of outdoor painting.
Yes, and it's a small book. You can order it online. It's you know, the prices vary. It's not cheap book, but it's an interesting read because it's very heady. But it's got a lot of amazing diagrams in there and some really good theories about composition. And like I said, that's like one of the major books that I want students to bring with them. I have a whole other list of various books that are wonderful too, but that one is like really, really good.
What was the name of it one more time?
The Composition of Outdoor Painting by Edgar Payne.
Edgar Payne.
Okay. I will, and everyone, I will see if we offer this at Northlight Shop, and if so, I'll be able to provide everyone with a coupon code for 10% off on it.
So. Oh, awesome.
And another one that I like is the, is it the Landscape Book by John Carlson.
Oh, the Carlson's Guide to Landscape Painting? That one?
Yes, thank you.
yeah, that's
that
also on my list, along with the, of course, the Richard Schmidt, Ella Prime, Everything I Know About Painting is like, that's like a Bible. Love that book.
Right.
And then another one that I also recommend, the painting, The Impressionist Landscape by Louis Griffel. It's a really, if people have a hard time with color, that's a great one to purchase because she offers like different color exercises in the book. They can be tedious and boring and annoying to do, but I know that when I did those exercises years ago, it really helped me to see color and be more intuitive with color and just see subtleties a lot more than before I read the book. So that's it. If color is like, you know, an area that you need to work on, that's a great book to get. And, of course, The Oil Painting Workshop Experience by Ted Gershner is nice, too. The Art Spirit is a lovely read, too, by Robert Henri. That's a nice one, too. And of course, the Composition of Outdoor Painting.
Excellent. And for everybody who's listening in, I'm going to share a link to this recording. So if you didn't get a chance to jot all those down, you'll be able to find it on YouTube and get that again. And I'll include as many links as I can in the follow-up email as well, because I know that we have Richard Schmidt's newest Alla Prima, the revised version of it, the newly released edition, at least. So we will do that. So one more question, and I think we have time for, and then we'll wrap it up. Julie has asked, what is your best experience teaching so far?
Wow. Let's see. I would say probably my very first workshop that I did. Only because, you know, a while back, I never really considered teaching at all because I thought, like, oh, I'm shy and I don't know, talking, blah, blah, blah. So I never really considered doing it. And it just was not part of my repertoire. Like, no. And then a very lovely friend of mine, Corrine, you know, was like really egging me on to do it. She said, you should really teach. Just start off with a small group and then build it just to get more comfortable with it. And then I started doing that. And then I finally did my first workshop in Arizona. Actually Grants, New Mexico, sorry. And it was really exhilarating because it's just like I broke out of my comfort zone to do this. And all these preconceived notions that I had about teaching and it was like just broken. And it was just like I realized I really, really enjoyed it, you know, and it was like a lot of fun because what she told me to help me kind of break out of that weird block that I had about teaching was like, just go and you pretend you're painting with friends and share what you love to do and share your knowledge. And so I thought, okay, I'll try it. I'll try approaching it that way. And when I did that, it was like, it was so much fun. And I like I said, I love sharing. I like to talk a lot. So that could benefit the students a lot sometimes, but if I go too much, then they get sleepy and start falling asleep. So I really found that it was such a wonderful experience for me. And then since then, I was hooked, and I just was teaching regularly from there. But I would say that was my best one. I mean, they're all wonderful. Each and every one of them are different. You know, it's a different experience. But I'm always blessed to have, like, such wonderful students that all get along, and just they're fun to be with, and we would bond new friendships. It's really wonderful, and seeing new locations and stuff. And each workshop I have, I always try to, like, improve it and make it better and better and better. And so sometimes I'll have a survey sheet, or maybe the venue will offer, like, a survey sheet as well. But I always talk to other people, other instructors, and ask them advice on how to make things better, because I want them to really have a great experience and come away, like, feeling very rewarded So, but I would say all of them have been wonderful. Mm-hmm. But that, my very first one was like the really, like, epiphany, like, oh my God, I want to do this. So
great. That is very inspiring, I can tell you.
Oh, thank you.
On the call. All right. Thank you. And thank you so much for joining us for this time.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Linda. I would like to thank everyone for joining us today. Linda, can you tell us a little bit about our next Art Chat for August?
Yeah, our next Art Chat is going to be with Carolyn Anderson. And Carolyn and I have been chatting on the phone and sending emails back and forth to one another. We're going to talk about color. And if anybody has studied with Carolyn or has talked with Carolyn, you know that she really digs into, like, the science of color and pigments and how light reacts with that. So this is really going to be, we started out thinking that we were just going to talk color temperature, and then the more that Carolyn and I talked, the more we got into so many other subjects on that we just decided to call it exploring color, or something close to that title. Sherry, when she sends the email out, we'll end up putting the actual title down. But it'll be with Carolyn Anderson. And it'll be, I think it's August 24th, right, Sherry?
I think so, yes.
Yeah. So you'll see some emails coming out from my newsletter on that. You'll also see it naturally mentioned in the F&W Artist Network emails and newsletters, Sherry's newsletter, things like that. So keep an eye out for that. It's going to be a great conversation on color.
Yes, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Really looking forward to it. Mm-hmm. And thanks, everyone, once again for joining us today. If you joined us late, you can listen to the complete recording of this webinar soon at artistnetwork.com. Have a great day, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.